Our second scripture reading this morning is Mark chapter 6, and we will read from verse 45 to verse 56. Mark chapter 6 and verse 45. Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. When they had crossed over there, they came to the land at Gennesaret and moored to the shore. And when they got out of the boat, the people immediately recognized him and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick people on their beds to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well. In 2013, Ricky Gervais, the British comedian, tweeted, "The Jesus story would have been so much better without all the magic and Son of God nonsense. An outspoken man who stood up for the meek, hero." I think Ricky Gervais captures many people's attitudes about Jesus. They like his moral teaching. They like him standing up for the weak and the oppressed. They don't like his miracles. They like what appears to be his socialism, but they don't really like his supernaturalism. They want Jesus with his morals. They're not so interested in Jesus with his miracles. But if you want to be a Christian this morning, then you have to believe in the whole Jesus, the Jesus of morals and the Jesus of miracles. Because Jesus's miracles are essential, not ornamental, to Christianity. Jesus' miracles are essential, not ornamental, to Christianity. What I mean is, if you take away the miracles of Jesus, you dismantle Christianity altogether. The miracles of Jesus are not decorative touches on Christianity. They're not added extras to jazz it up. The miracles of Jesus are essential to Christianity. C.S. Lewis, in his sermon, The Grand Miracle, states that this is not the case with religions like Buddhism and Islam. For example, in Buddhism, if you take away the miracles attributed to Gautama the Buddha, there's no loss to the religion. In fact, the religion gets on just fine without the miracles of Buddha. Precisely because in his teaching, Buddha was against the natural world. Reality is out there, not down here. And so miracles done down here are not that real anyway. And it's the same with Islam. Remove the miracles of Muhammad and nothing essential changes with respect to the Muslim religion. You still have a great prophet preaching his dogmas. The miracles of Muhammad are a digression, a distraction to the main story of Islam. But Jesus' miracles, They're not a digression or a distraction like in Islam. They're not superfluous like in Buddhism. Remove the miracles of Jesus and you dismantle Christianity. Because Jesus' miracles are essential, not ornamental to Christianity. And that's because all of his miracles are mini miracles of a bigger miracle. All of Jesus' miracles are miniature miracles of one grand miracle. The miracle of the incarnation. That in the person of Jesus Christ, God became a man. And that's why Jesus' miracles are essential to Christianity. Because they reveal the grand miracle that Jesus is God in human flesh. Strip Buddhism of its miracles and you've still got Buddhism. Strip Islam of Muhammad's miracles and you still have Islam. Strip Christianity of its miracles and you no longer have Christianity. Because Jesus' miracles reveal something about himself. They reveal that he is God. And that is what Christianity is about. It is about Christ, the God-man. That is what is at the heart of Christianity. The identity of Jesus Christ as God. He is God's Son, and as the Son of the Father, he is equal to the Father in his being. And his miracles are there to reveal that one grand miracle, that God became a man. So when we come across a miracle of Jesus in the Bible, we are not simply seeing an exhibition of divine power, though we certainly do see that. What we are seeing is a revelation of divine presence. Let me say that again. When we come across a miracle in the Bible, we are not seeing simply an exhibition of divine power. We are seeing a revelation of divine presence. Because in the Old Testament, there were people who performed miracles, but who were not God. They exhibited divine power, but they did not reveal divine presence. Just think of Moses. I'm sure, boys and girls, you can remember some of the miracles of Moses. Do you remember when Moses threw his staff on the ground in front of Pharaoh and it became a snake? But Moses was not God in human flesh. Do you remember when he held his staff out over the Red Sea and the wind blew and the waters parted? But Moses was not God in human flesh. Do you remember when he struck the rock with his stick and water came out for Israel to drink from? But Moses was not God in human flesh. Or think of Elijah. Elijah multiplied flour and oil for a widow. But Elijah was not God in human flesh. He raised her son from the dead. But Elijah was not God in human flesh. Like Moses, he parted the waters of the Jordan by striking them with his coat. But Elijah was not God in human flesh. Do you see it? In the Old Testament, there were people who performed miracles, who exhibited divine power, but who were not God. This is why when Jesus comes on the scene doing miracles, what do people say? He's Elijah. He's one of the prophets of old. Why? Because Elijah and the prophets of old, like Moses, performed miracles that exhibited divine power. Moses and Elijah controlled nature. Jesus calmed a storm. Moses exhibited divine power, supplying water to people in the desert. Elijah did it by multiplying flour and oil. Jesus provides bread and fish in a desert. Elijah exhibited divine power by raising a widow's son from the dead. Jesus raises Jairus' daughter from the dead. At one level, Jesus could be interpreted as being like Moses and Elijah, a prophet with divine power. But what Mark wants us to show this morning, wants to show us this morning, is that Jesus' miracles, every one of them, is not simply an exhibition of divine power. It is a revelation of divine presence. They are mini miracles of the grand miracle, that this is God who has come walking into history. And Mark shows us this morning in three ways. Number one, Jesus walks where only God can walk. Jesus walks where only God can walk. Verse 45. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And they saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. Now, it's important to notice how Jesus orchestrates this miracle, just like he did last week. Verse 45 tells us that after feeding the 5,000, he immediately sends his disciples away in a boat to Bethsaida on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. He wants them in a boat in the sea without him. The verb made in verse 45 is a strong verb. It means he compelled them. He forced them into the boat. In other words, it gives the impression that the disciples were reluctant to leave the crowd. Now, Mark doesn't explain why Jesus had to force his disciples into the boat. But if you read this same account in John chapter 6, we can read between the lines of what is going on here. Galilee, which is where this crowd were from, was the Freedom Movement region of Palestine. Rural Galilee was the stronghold of the Zealot Movement. The Zealot Movement was founded in AD, 6 AD by Judas the Galilean, who had fought against the Romans to free the region from Roman rule and oppression. In other words, Galilee was the place from which freedom fighters arose. And here is Jesus, who is from Nazareth in Galilee, presenting himself as a leader, as we saw last week. Remember, he got the men to sit in formations of 150s, like a commander setting up his military formation. And so the expectations of 5,000 men from Galilee would have been raised. Is this the Messiah whom God promised, who would come and fight for us and kick the Romans out of town? And this is exactly what John tells us in his gospel. After recounting the feeding of the 5,000, John says that the people intended to come and make Jesus king by force. So this explains why Jesus quickly forces his disciples into the boat and then leaves himself and goes away from the crowd. Because his disciples were susceptible to viewing him as the wrong kind of Messiah, as a political Messiah, as a freedom-fighting Messiah, and not God's suffering Messiah. The disciples were from Galilee. Peter was a zealot. Do you remember he cut off the Roman soldier's ear when he comes to arrest Jesus? These men were men who wanted a political, freedom-fighting Messiah. And Jesus forces them into the boat because he wants to reveal to them who he really is. So they get away from the crowd. But the question is, why didn't Jesus get into the boat? Well, verse 46 tells us that he wanted to pray on his own. And I think this reveals his own humanity, his own temptation to be the crowd's Messiah, not God's Messiah. In Mark's gospel, there are three accounts of Jesus praying. In chapter 1, chapter 6, and then in chapter 14 in the Garden of Gethsemane. And each time he's praying, it's in the dark, and it's in the context of being tempted to be distracted from his calling. In chapter 1, the crowds are flocking to him because they want him for his healing. Here in chapter 6, they want a revolution in a Roman Empire. And in chapter 14, he is tempted to not go through with the cross. So he retreats to pray after the crowd want to make him king by force. But he also retreats in order to create the circumstances in which to make this miracle possible. Look at verse 47. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. Do you see the distance that Mark emphasizes between Jesus and his disciples? They are in a boat out at sea. He's on the land on his own. It's the distance that creates the distress. Separation from Jesus is always precarious. It always involves danger and distress. And the distress is that they're caught in this headwind. Now, the wind was known as the Sharkia. The Sharkia. It was as terrifying as it sounds. It was an easterly wind that blew off from the northeast over the Sea of Galilee, and it was known to cause consternation for fishermen. And the disciples are caught in it. They had set out from the northwest of the Sea of Galilee, and they're heading over to Bethsaida in the northeast, and they're caught in this wind that's hitting them straight on. The word painfully here is used elsewhere in the Bible for torment in hell. It's used for the pain a woman experiences in childbirth. So the disciples here are in torment. They are in great pain. They're having a hard time. And they're having a hard time for a long time. You notice the time that's passed? The wind starts in the evening and it continues into the fourth watch of the night. That's 3 a.m. in the morning. So Jesus sees them struggling in the evening, and he leaves them for about 7 to 9 hours, rowing in a wind. Notice how deliberate Jesus has been in leaving them to struggle for so long. He wants them to be utterly exhausted. He wants them to be in the darkest moment of the night. He wants them to come to an end of themselves before he reveals himself to them. And when he does, it is the most spectacular thing they could ever have imagined. Verse 48. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the water. Now, some people try to play this down. They say, no. The disciples saw an illusion. Given that they were exhausted, rowing for 7 to 9 hours, given that it was dark, the disciples have just mistook Jesus in a boat. He's come to them in a boat, standing up. And so what they've done is they've taken this story and they've just exaggerated it. Well, how Jesus rowed in a boat on his own for 7 to 9 hours to catch up with them, we don't know. Or how would that be? Others say no. Given the strong wind, the disciples were rowing close to the shore. And Jesus was just walking along the shore. Or he was walking on a sandbar in the water. That's what they saw. And so this story has been exaggerated to make it more spectacular. Because, I mean, come on. Let's get real here. Who of us has ever walked on water? I mean, boys and girls, tonight, when you go home, you have your bath, try and walk on the water in the bath. It won't work. It doesn't work. The only reason that people deny Jesus the miracle is because they deny Jesus his identity. The only reason people deny Jesus this miracle is because they deny Jesus his identity. You see, if you're God, walking on top of water that you have created is not that difficult when you think about it. If you're the Creator God who made the water, then it's entirely reasonable that you could walk on it. A creator mastering his creation makes complete sense. And that is what Jesus is showing us here. He is the Creator God. He is no mere man. He is a man. He is fully man. In a sense, he is showing himself to be the true man, ruling the world and the waves. But he is no mere man. He is the God-man, God in human flesh. And that's why this miracle is not so much an exhibition of divine power, but a revelation of divine presence. Because anyone steeped in the Old Testament would know that what Jesus is doing here is only what God could do. Listen to Job chapter 9, verse 8. God alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea. Behold, he passes by me, and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him. Job chapter 38, God speaks to Job and says, have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? The implication being that God has. Do you see it? Jesus walks where only God can walk. God is known in the Old Testament for planting his footsteps in the sea, for riding upon the storm. And here is Jesus planting his footsteps in the sea, riding upon the storm. Jesus walks where only God can walk. Which means that this miracle is not so much an exhibition of divine power, though it certainly is that. It is primarily a revelation of divine presence. Jesus has come to his disciples just as God would have come to these disciples, walking on the water. And this makes sense of the enigmatic phrase at the end of verse 48. Did you notice it? Jesus meant to pass by them. It sort of sounds like Jesus didn't want them to see him. But again, we need to see an Old Testament allusion here. In the Old Testament, when God wanted to reveal himself to people, he is said to pass by them. So on Mount Sinai, Moses asked to see God's glory, and God said, I will make all my goodness pass before you. And while my glory passes by, I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. God passing by Moses at Mount Sinai was God revealing himself to Moses. Same happens with Elijah on Mount Horeb. Same mountain, different name on a different occasion. Elijah saw God pass by. And it's the same here. Jesus wants to pass by, not so that they miss him, but so that they see him for who he is. God walking on the waves. So Jesus walking on the water, passing by them, it's not a code to be cracked. It's not a puzzle to be solved. It's a revelation to behold. God has come to the disciples. And by doing what he does, Jesus answers the question that they asked the last time they were in a boat in a storm. Do you remember in chapter 4? Jesus calms the storm and they say, who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? And here is Jesus in the second sea crossing giving them the answer. I'm God. That's who this is. But rather than responding with trust, they respond with terror. Look at verse 49. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. The word ghost here is very rare. It's phantasma, from which we get fantastic or fantasy. The rarity of the word shows that the disciples didn't know how to categorize this. Seeing ghosts was not a common thing. So they think, what on earth are we looking at here? This has got to be something out of this world that we've never seen before. So they think it's a ghost and they scream in terror. Now, boys and girls, I don't know if you've ever been scared by something at night time, or maybe by someone jumping out on you behind a door when you're not expecting it. But if it happens to you, it's a scary thing. And that's what Jesus does here. He doesn't jump out at his disciples, but he does frighten them. And boys and girls, that is an important thing to grasp this morning. Jesus is more terrifying than nature. Jesus is more terrifying than a storm out at sea. As Badger says about Aslan in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, he's wild, you know, not like a tame lion. Jesus is wild, and he is more wild than a strong wind, because he is God. And he walks where only God can walk. But Mark shows us something else. Jesus walks where only God can walk. And second, Jesus talks like only God can talk. Jesus talks like only God can talk. Verses 50 to 52. But immediately, Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." Now, it's the middle three words that we need to notice here. It is I. Literally, I am. Take heart, I am. Now, boys and girls, what does that remind you of? Do you remember the children's talk about 3 weeks ago where Mr. Hamilton told us what God's name was? God's name that he revealed to Moses on Mount Sinai was, I am who I am. And for short, God's name is I am. That's God's name. And here is Jesus taking God's name for himself. He talks like only God can talk. Now, this is maybe not surprising to us, but it was deeply surprising to Jewish people, because God's name was holy. It was untouchable. It was unusable. No human being would ever think of speaking in a way that sounded like they had God's name. And we don't really get this, because in our society, people who are really important to us, their names are taken by us all the time. So just think about the name Elizabeth. Wonder if you have a friend at school or someone in your class at university or a grandmother with the name Elizabeth. My grandmother was called Elizabeth. Jackie and I have a friend who's just recently had a daughter, and she named her Eve Elizabeth. What's interesting is that's the name of our queen. My grandmother was named the same as the queen. Our friend's baby girl has the same name as the queen. And in our culture, taking the queen's name is no big deal. You want to call your daughter Elizabeth? Just call her Elizabeth. But in the Jewish culture, you did not call your son I am. And you did not call yourself I am. It is blasphemy to do that. And yet here is Jesus taking the name of God. He talks like only God can talk. And that's why this miracle is not an exhibition of divine power primarily. It is primarily a revelation of divine presence. God has come to his disciples. But look what surrounds Jesus saying, I am. Take heart, take courage, and do not be afraid. In the Old Testament, the only person who says, do not be afraid to Israel, is God. Do you see it? Here is Jesus talking like God. And what surrounds the I am are words of comfort. This is a wonderful example of how Jesus never performs a miracle just to show off his divine power. He's not a magician trying to draw a crowd. He's not a cult leader trying to raise a movement. He's God, terrifying and awesome, more terrifying and awesome than unruly nature itself. But he is also compassionate and gracious. His presence is frightening. His presence is terrifying. But his presence is also comforting. When you realize who Jesus is, his presence should terrify you. But it should also comfort you. Because Jesus is God with us. That's the whole point here. He comes to be with his disciples. And he gets into the boat with his disciples. And the wind ceases. His presence comforts. However, instead of being comforted, his disciples are astounded. Verse 51. And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded. Now, sadly, this doesn't mean that they were overawed with reverent fear at who Jesus was, God in human flesh, and they bowed down and worshipped. No. Sadly, they still don't understand who has just come walking to them in the water, because they still don't yet understand who broke bread with them the previous evening. They don't get who Jesus is. In the first sea crossing, they said, "Who is this?" In this sea crossing, Jesus says, "I'm God. I walk where only God can walk. I talk like only God can talk." Yet, they do not see it. Now, that is amazing. If you take time to read the whole Gospel of Mark, it is amazing that at this point they don't see it. So far, this is what they have seen. They've seen Jesus heal a man with an unclean spirit in a synagogue. They've seen him raise Peter's mother-in-law from a fever. They've seen him heal the leper, heal the paralytic, heal the man with a withered hand. They've seen him calm a storm. They've seen him heal the demon-possessed man called Legion. They've seen him heal the woman who had suffered 12 years of bleeding. They've seen him raise Jairus' daughter from the dead. They've seen him feed 5,000 people. And they've just seen him walk on water. 11 distinct miracles. Besides the general miracles of healing the crowds, they've even been on a mission trip for Jesus. They've cast out demons in his name. They've healed the sick themselves in his name. And they still don't see it. Now that is amazing. Bertrand Russell, the British atheist, was once asked, "If when you die, you do actually meet God, what would you say to him?" Bertrand Russell replied, "I'll tell him he never gave me enough evidence." Well, here's the shocking thing, isn't it? Even if Jesus performed all of these miracles in front of Bertrand Russell, he still wouldn't have believed. Just look at the disciples. It takes more than seeing a miracle of Jesus to believe. It takes more than coming into contact with a revelation of his divine presence to believe. Which means, friends, that if you're here this morning and you do believe in Jesus' miracles, then another miracle has already taken place. And that is that your hard heart has been changed. Because you and I, in our natures, are just like these disciples. We are blind. Our hearts are hard. Because the issue is not what you see with your eyes. The issue is the state of your heart. And if your heart is hard, then you will never see Jesus for who he is. Even if he came walking to you on the water. Well, Mark does show us a third way that Jesus reveals God's presence. Jesus heals like only God can heal. Jesus heals like only God can heal. Verses 53 to 56. Jesus crosses over into the land of the Gennesaret and moors by the shore, and crowds of people flock to him, and whoever touched him is healed. He's like a magnet. These crowds just come to him. And they say, if we can just touch your garments, we will be healed. And the end of verse 56 says, and as many as touched him, the it is not a great translation, as many as touched him were made well. Now what does this remind us of? Well, in the Old Testament, God passes through the Red Sea with Israel, and they come to a place called Marah. And the water is bitter, and God miraculously changes the water. And then God says to them, I am your healer, Israel. Do you see it? God crosses the Red Sea and presents himself to his people as their healer. Jesus crosses the sea here, and he presents himself as their healer. Jesus is God. Jesus walks where only God can walk. Jesus talks like only God can talk. And Jesus heals like only God can heal. His miracles are not simply exhibitions of divine power, though they certainly are that. His miracles are revelations of divine presence. And this is why they are essential, not ornamental, to Christianity. You can't have Jesus without his miracles. There are people like Ricky Gervais who just want the Jesus with his morals, but they don't want the Jesus with his miracles. But Jesus comes to us this morning, walking off the pages of the Bible to us, and says, do you want me? Then you have to have me with my miracles, because that is who I am. All of these miracles are a revelation of the grand miracle, that I am your God who has come to you. The question this morning that we need to ask ourselves is, do we see it? Or are we like the disciples? For they did not understand the miracle, but their hearts were hardened.